In this part of Focus 580, we'll be looking back to the longest war crimes investigation of the Vietnam War. In the early days of the war, the U.S. Army created an experimental fighting unit that came to be known as Tiger Force. The soldiers of Tiger Force had a couple of missions, to act as commandos, but also to scout targets for bombing. And their missions would take them deep into enemy territory. The idea is that they would go places where other soldiers hadn't gone. Tiger Force was, by all accounts, at least the open accounts, successful. They took a lot of casualties. They saw a lot of action. They were highly decorated. However, in early 2002, or actually in late 2002, some reporters from the Toledo Blade newspaper came onto a large cache of documents indicating that the military had investigated Tiger Force, some members of Tiger Force, had investigated them for war crimes. And the newspaper eventually reported that the Army had indeed found evidence of war crimes, but filed no charges. And to this day, it is essentially an open case. This morning in this second hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Mitch Weiss. He is one of the reporters who covered this story for the paper. And for that story that was published in 2004 in The Blade, won the Pulitzer Prize. He and his co-author here, Michael Sala, have now expanded the story and published it as a book, which has fairly recently been published. The title of the book is Tiger Force, A True Story of Men and War by Mike Sala and Mitch Weiss. It is published by Little Brown. It is out in the bookstores now if you want to take a look at it. Also there, you can go to the website of the Toledo Blade, as I did, and you can read the original stories there and also some of what's been happening recently in connection with the story. So there are a couple of ways if you'd like to find out more about it, and you can do that. And here this morning on the program as we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you'd like to be involved in the conversation, you certainly can do that. The only thing we ask is people just try and be brief so that we can get in as many people as possible and keep the program moving. But anyone's welcome to call. Again, 333-9455 here for Champaign-Urbana and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Weiss, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I certainly appreciate it. Perhaps to start, you might talk a little bit about how it is that Tiger Force came to be put together and sort of what the idea behind Tiger Force was.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Not a problem. Well, Tiger Force was an elite unit. It was part of the 101st Airborne. And basically, the first U.S. fighting troops that went to Vietnam were in 1965. And when our troops arrived, we were using conventional weapons. We were using big tanks and guns and big line companies. And we quickly found that that wasn't working in Vietnam. We were facing a different kind of enemy. It was almost like an invisible enemy. We were talking about the Viet Cong and the NVA, and they had been there for a while, and they had been fighting, you know, first, you know, the Japanese during World War II, and then, you know, the French. And now they were so entrenched in Vietnam, they fought in these intricate underground tunnels. And here we were using these World War II, Korean War kinds of weapons. So what happened was, with the 101st Airborne, there was a commander, David Hackworth, who later became a CNN analyst. And he decided that he was going to create a unit that would out-guerrilla the guerrillas. And the unit was, it was called a Recondo unit. They were part reconnaissance, part commando. And essentially their job at the very beginning, and they were created in October 1965, but their job was to go deep into the jungles. They were 45 men, and they were broken into small teams, and they would go deep into the jungles, and they would spy on the enemy. Then they would call in airstrikes, and then after the airstrikes, they would go into the base camps to count the number of dead and try to retrieve weapons and other information. But they were also used as a blocking unit. So in other words, if there were NVA or Viet Cong, you know, fleeing from a particular area, they would actually act as a tiny line company. And it was a heroic unit in the first 18 months in Vietnam. In fact, there was a Medal of Honor winner, one of the commanders, a James Gardner, and it was indeed a heroic unit. But things started to change when they were moved up to the Quang Nai province, and their mission changed. They were no longer really doing reconnaissance. They were asked when they were moved in May 1967 to the Quang Nai province to remove villagers. Basically, you had these Buddhist farmers who were growing rice, and these farmers didn't like the government of Saigon, and they really didn't like the NVA or Hanoi. They really wanted to be left alone. But our military commanders knew that they were growing rice and that the NVA and the Viet Cong were coming in and stealing it. So our philosophy, our plan was to move them from these villages to relocation camps, which were condemned by the State Department because of their conditions. So people were removed from the land to these relocation camps, and then they went back. And Tiger Force's mission at that point, like I said, changed. They started removing these villagers, then the villagers would come back, and they'd have to go and remove them again. Meanwhile, they're being hit by the NVA, they're being hit by the Viet Cong, by snipers, and the frustration level started to come up, and soon, you know, they started killing prisoners, and then they started killing unarmed civilians, and it was a seven-month period from May 1967 through November of 1967 in which they killed hundreds of unarmed men, women, and children.
Yeah. It seems that part of the problem, and this was in the nature of that war, part of the problem was that they were told that anyone could be the enemy, and it was possible that anyone could be the enemy, but that there seemed to be a little bit fuzzy on rules of engagement, because it was also sort of my understanding that they were told that if they were fired upon, they could fire back, but they weren't supposed to shoot at anybody unless they were fired upon. And so they were put into the situation where it sounds as if the rules of who they could shoot were fuzzy enough so that they started to believe that essentially they could shoot anybody.
Well, exactly. And you have to remember the nature of the war. This was not a war about territory. This was a war of attrition. This was a war in which we judged our success by how many more of them we killed than they killed of us. So it was really a war of body count. And that was really the mantra. And what you were just alluding to was there were rules of engagement. Basically, you could fire on people who had weapons, but the Army created a term. It was called a free fire zone. And basically, what a free fire zone was is, since we were in a foreign country, we had to ask permission of the South Vietnamese when we went into an area, you know, whether we could actually, you know, fire. We would go, we suspect there are enemy, you know, troops in this area. We're going to go in. We're going to bomb it. We need your permission first. And then they would create a free fire zone. And then you could go into that area, but you could only fire on combatants. The problem was that the commanders took it to mean, literally, it was a free fire zone. And anybody in those areas, like the Quang Nai province where Tiger Force was located from May until June in 1967, that everybody was fair game. So if you were a farmer and you were in that area and it was declared a free fire zone, it meant, you know, they perverted the actual meaning so that the troops took it, hey, we could freely fire on anybody who was in there, and that was wrong. Mm-hmm. And later the military did drop free fire zones from the lexicon.
And I think sort of one further thing is, and you touched on it, is that this was at a time when there was a lot of pressure on these units in the field to achieve results, and results were defined in terms of how many of the enemy were killed, and it sounds as if they weren't counting very carefully. They were just counting bodies, and that there wasn't a real effort to substantiate whether somebody that got killed on the other side was a combatant or not. They were just counting heads.
Well, exactly. And one of the keys that you could tell is every time they killed someone, they would also have to phone in whether or not they had weapons. And towards the end of Tiger Force's rampage in November of 1967, they were just calling in, killed someone fleeing from a hooch, no weapons found. And you would see it in the records that, indeed, they very rarely found any weapons. And to just go back, you have to understand the political climate at the time. This was from May to November 1967. You know, the public was still supporting, you know, the war. We still thought we could win it. Westmoreland was saying, you know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. Victory's right around the corner. But, you know, the White House knew, And Westmoreland knew that that wasn't the case. And so there was great pressure put on Westmoreland and the military to kind of wrap this thing up by the end of 67. And what we didn't know and what we found out later was that the NVA had been moving troops down for 6 months in anticipation of the Tet Offensive in January 1968, and that indeed, you know, there was no light at the end of the tunnel. But there was intense pressure at that point, especially in the Central Highlands, where we thought the NVA and Viet Cong were making inroads and that they could possibly cut the country in half to wrap this thing up. And if that meant killing whoever was out there, then so be it.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus, let me reintroduce, is Mitch Weiss, along with Michael Sala. He is the co-author of the book Tiger Force, A True Story of Men and War. It's published by Little Brown. They, two of them, received the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting for their work on this story for the Toledo Blade newspaper. And then they expanded upon that, and that's the book that you can read now. Mitch Weiss is now an editor with the Charlotte Observer. He's not with the Blade anymore. But the Blade does continue to follow this story, or at least as recently as a couple of years ago, they were still following it. And you can read some of that still on the website of the newspaper, the Toledo Blade. Or if you want to read the story, obviously, you can go out and look for the book Tiger Force, which is in bookstores now. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I know that in the course of doing the investigative work for the story and for the book, that you and your co-author, I think, eventually talked with more than 40 former Tigers. So you got the opportunity to talk with them about their experiences. Some men told you what they saw. Some men told you what they did. If you ask this question, if you look at these guys, what you learned about them, do you think that anything about them would have set them apart from your average combat soldier in Vietnam, either good or bad?
Well, you have to look at the Tigers. They were not your traditional combat soldiers. Most of the soldiers in Vietnam were draftees. These guys in Tiger Force were all enlistees. They all volunteered for the military. And not only did they volunteer for the military, they volunteered for the 101st Airborne. You know, they became paratroopers. I mean, that's an elite division in itself. You know, the 101st, I mean, if you look at the book Band of Brothers, it was written about the 101st Airborne. And, you know, at first Tiger Force, when it was set up in 1965, you had to have at least 3 months combat experience, and you were screened and you were asked by commanders about your willingness to kill, sometimes up close and personal, whether you would be willing and able to grab, you know, an enemy soldier from behind and slit their throat so they wouldn't, you know, call out to other soldiers. So, I mean, there were rules about getting into Tiger Force, but this is where it changed. When they move up to the Quang Nai province in 1967, and now they're asked to, you know, do this almost civilian affairs kind of work instead of this recon, you know, work, there was something else that happened. On May 15th, 1967, they were in an ambush, and of the 45 members, two were killed, 28 were wounded. So now the Army needed to replenish the ranks of Tiger Force. So instead of getting the best of the best, you know, guys who had been in combat 3 months at least, and you had this, you know, intense screening process, they were letting anybody in because they had to refill the ranks. And at that point, they get a commander, this lieutenant. His name was James Hawkins. And he was a guy who basically encouraged this unit to kill. You have to realize that the soldiers, you know, they were 18, 19, 20 years old, and you had these team leaders who oversaw them, and they broke into these small teams. And the team leaders set the tone for this particular unit. And this is what we wanted to emphasize in the book, that it's really about commanders and team leaders setting the tone. And so what happened is you had these really good soldiers who are watching their team leaders killing unarmed civilians and encouraging them to kill unarmed civilians. And that's when the breakdown occurred. But again, these soldiers of Tiger Force, they were considered, you know, different than other soldiers because they were from the 101st Airborne. They were paratroopers. Mm.
There, and when you start asking this question, what happened? Where was the failure here? I think right away you have to say, or once you learn a little bit about the story, you have to say this was a failure of leadership, and that men like James Hawkins, who apparently there, at least as of a couple of years ago, there was some discussion about the possibility he actually could still be tried, that it was people like him that bear maybe the greatest piece of responsibility, because they were the ones who were leading the unit on the ground. They were the ones who were setting the model for this kind of behavior. So again, if you have to ask this question, well, who really is most responsible? It would be people like that at that level.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, guys like Lieutenant Hawkins and you know, there was a sergeant in there. His name was Harold Trout, who was one of the worst offenders. Another sergeant, William Doyle, who was a sadist. But also the commanders. I mean, the one thing about Tiger Force, which was very interesting, were there were two guys in the unit in 1967 who complained to their superiors, a Lieutenant Donald Wood, who was from Ohio, who saw the killing, who tried to countermand the orders. And then, you know, when it got too much, he went to his commanders and complained, and he was told, you know, you expect me to pull these guys out of the field because they killed a few, you know, unarmed civilians? So he complained, and it still bothered him so much that when he rotated out, you know, when he was back in the United States in 1968, he complained and got the same response. Then there was a Sergeant Gerald Bruner, who was from Michigan, and he turned his gun on a fellow Tiger to stop him from killing an unarmed teenager. And he, you know, for doing that, he was told that he was crazy, he should see a psychiatrist, and eventually he was transferred out of the unit. Then you had commanders like Lieutenant Colonel Gerald Morse, who knew what was going on and encouraged the killing. So, you know, while the Army investigation starts in 1971 and lasts to 1975, commanders in the field at the time knew what was going on, and they failed to take steps to stop it.
There, you did mention this man who would have been the Lieutenant Colonel Morse, who would have been a step above in the chain of command, Hawkins, and that said that he knew what was going on. And I think that he was the guy who said, you're the 327th, so I want 327 kills?
Yes. There was an operation. It was called Operation Wheeler, and it lasted from, I think, September through the end of November. And it was an operation to take back the Central Highlands. And at the time, Gerald Morse was the commander. And towards the end of the campaign, he said that, I want 327 kills by a certain date. And I could date offhand, I think it was like November 19th, 1967. And 327 was significant because he was in charge of the 1st Infantry 327th Battalion. So he wanted to get the insignia number. Bottom line was, a few days after he issued that order over the radio, and it was heard by everybody in, you know, out in the field, a Tiger did kill, and it's noted in the government records, did record the 327th kill. Of course, no weapons were found. And for his reward, he got a case of beer. So, you know, that just shows you the extent that the commanders knew what was going on out in the field.
It eventually, when the investigation took place, the results were made known to people in the Pentagon, and I guess your feeling is that also it was made known to the White House. But at the time when this was going on, say in 1967, how far up the chain of command do you think it was known what the Tigers were doing?
Well, in 1967, it probably went up to the battalion headquarters. So in other words, you know, the commander, Gerald Morse, knew, and everybody under Gerald Morse knew. In fact, the battalion surgeon, when he's later interviewed by CID, says, look, we knew what was going on, but we just didn't want to investigate because we were afraid of what we'd find out. And I later interviewed him. His name is Bradford Mutchler, and he's retired now. He's from, I'm trying to think of where in Kentucky. I think Paducah, Kentucky. And I asked him about that, and he said, yeah, we knew. But we didn't want to, you know, we didn't want to investigate. We didn't, you know, it was, you know, don't ask, don't tell. It was that kind of thing. Now, the Army's investigation of Tiger Force doesn't begin until 1971, which is 4 years after the atrocities took place. And the reason that they even started the investigation was, it was right after My Lai came out, and you know, CID was under orders to investigate all war crimes allegations. So they were investigating, you know, a war crimes case, and they came to a guy named Gary Coy, and Gary Coy said, no, I don't know anything about the particular war crimes case that you're talking about, but I do know of a case where a soldier named Sam, and he was with Tiger Force, cut the head off a baby. And that statement that was made in February 1971 started the Tiger Force investigation. And by the time it was over in November of 1975, the Army had interviewed more than 100 people and sent agents out to 60 cities, all over the world, interviewing former Tiger Force members, commanders, and guys who were still in the military at the time.
And here, and let me just ask one more question to round this out, and then I've got a caller I want to get to. The important point is here that as a result of this investigation, the Army itself identified 18 former soldiers who had survived the war, who were living, and identified 20 instances of war crimes. So indeed, the Army itself, as a result of its investigation, said, yes, we believe there is enough evidence here of war crimes having committed so that someone could be charged. What happened?
Well, you're absolutely right. In fact, our investigation in part was based on those government records. What happened was, there was an investigator, his name was Gustav Apsey, and he was a guy with the Army who held together this case. He files his final report in 1975, towards the end of 1975, and in there, you're absolutely right, he says that we have, we've substantiated at least 20 war crimes involving 18, Tiger Force soldiers, and we're talking about hundreds of victims. And he fully expected the government to do something, at least to court-martial one or two of the former Tigers who were still in the military, like James Hawkins. What happened was, after he files his final report, he thinks he's going to get a promotion, he may have to testify in this case. Instead, he gets a phone call, and he's told he's being transferred to a CID office in Seoul, Korea. But what makes matters worse is that in November of 1975, this case, the Army kills this case. And that's the same month that Donald Rumsfeld takes over as Secretary of Defense under Gerald Ford, and Dick Cheney is elevated to Chief of Staff under President Ford as well. The same players who are on the scene now. And because of the documents and the paper trail, we know that all war crimes cases were forwarded to the Defense Department, to the White House, to the Secretary of the Army. And it's hard for us to believe that nobody, that Rumsfeld, Cheney, or anybody in the Ford administration didn't know about this case, because it was the last war crimes case of the Vietnam War, and that this case, if it came out, had potential to derail his, re-election bid in 1976. And so we haven't found, the smoking gun, so to speak. But in our minds, we definitely think that Rumsfeld played a role in killing it.
Yeah, and this already would have been after My Lai, so they would have been interested in not having the kind of story like that come out again. They figured it would be bad. Not only might it be bad for the president and his reelection chances, but also certainly would be very, very bad for the military.
Well, exactly. Look at November 1965. Ford is really focused on the economy. We're in double-digit inflation. And, if they would have court-martialed a James Hawkins in November of 1975, the media would have been all over the case. And it would have been, My Lai Part 2, so to speak. And the attention would have been focused on this. And also the media would have asked, I think, and rightfully so, okay, you've spent 4.5 years investigating this, you've substantiated these crimes, how come we didn't know anything about it? I think the public would have been appalled at the time to find out that there was a case this big that the government had been keeping secret all along.
Yeah. Well, we are at a midpoint here, and I promise that the caller I want to get right to.
Let me
quickly introduce again our guest. We're talking with Mitch Weiss. He's now an editor with the Charlotte Observer. He's former reporter for the Toledo Blade. He and Michael Sala are authors of a book, Tiger Force, The True Story of Men and War. It is published by Little Brown, and it is an expanded version of a story that they wrote for The Blade that received the Pulitzer Prize for Investigative Reporting in 2004. The book is out in bookstores now, and certainly you can read it. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have somebody here who's been patient with us, someone calling on our toll free line, so we'll go right there, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Is it all right, me? Line 4?
Yes.
All right, thank you. Sorry about that. I was in toward the end of the Vietnam War, and I was just wondering if you covered any of this. I had heard, I didn't have to go. I wasn't in Nam. But I had heard that toward the end of the Vietnam War, the recon, some of the units, were seeing six buys of U.S. prisoners going north to prison camps. And this was quashed real quick by the U.S. government. And I wonder if you knew anything about that, because what was going on is some of the squads were going north of the DMZ. And, excuse me, I'm a little nervous here. And they observed these, and then the government, this is what I heard now, the government had sent some CIA agents and were trying to off some of the squad members because they were witnesses of some of these six buys of U.S. prisoners going north. Did you do any of that kind of studying, or have you heard anything like that? And then I'll hang up and I'll listen on the air.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. Yeah.
No, we didn't look into any of those allegations, and this is, to be honest, the first time that I've heard about those allegations about units heading north. We didn't look into that.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry that that's the best response we can give. Now, I want to say though, I know that this is something that you spent a lot of time and a lot of effort on. This was a major investigative piece, and I'm sure that since that time, since the time you did the pieces for the newspaper, you've spent an awful lot more time, you and your co-author here, concentrating on this particular story. I know you traveled around the country to talk to people. You went to Vietnam to talk to people. This was a major, major enterprise on both of your parts, concentrating on this specific event, trying to find out as much about it as you could, trying to talk to as many different people as you could. So I think you really have to acknowledge what a very significant piece of journalism this is.
No, thank you. Yeah, we had after the series ran, we decided that we were going to do the book. I mean, the amount of research was just incredible, especially since we wanted to show the soldier's side and in the book, and I think we do that, but that meant going back and digging even deeper and deeper into their personalities and what made them tick, and so that you can see, what happens when you get bad leaderships and how these soldiers, who a lot of them were really good kids, could go over to the dark side, so to speak.
Yeah, and one of the aspects of the story that is really sad, in addition to what it was that they may have done while they were there, is the effect that the experience of being in Vietnam had on their lives ever after.
Exactly. Most of the one thing that we were shocked to find out is that most of the Tigers, even though the nature of their assignment was so dangerous, most of them survived the war. Very few were actually killed in combat. However, when they came back, they were different people. They had they had difficulty functioning to regular jobs and regular everyday life. A lot of them turned to drugs and alcohol. They had three, four, sometimes even five marriages, and they died young. One of the people that we write about, Sam Ybarra, he who was one of the most notorious killers in Tiger Force, and in fact, the story kind of involves him and his friendship with his childhood buddy, Boots Green. Is that he died at the age of 36 of alcoholism. He was 95 pounds. And, when he died on the Indian Reservation in Globe, Arizona. And you see the same common threads running through a lot of the characters. They didn't lead normal lives. And for me, that was a tough part because while I was too young to go to Vietnam, my brother was in Vietnam. He was drafted and served in an Army unit up near Quy Nhon in 1969 and 1970. So it was very tough because I remember what my brother went through and people in my neighborhood. I grew up in the Bronx. When they were drafted, they went into the military. There really wasn't a way out for them. And I saw the kind of effect it had. So I think that for me, it was the toughest part of the interviews with the vets, and what they're doing today was the toughest part for me.
Let's talk with some other callers here. We'll go to line number one, Champaign County. Hello.
Yeah, I wanted to actually ask about that, whether anybody's doing the kind of psychological post-traumatic stress. We must remember that there are millions of Vietnamese victims, too, but it seems to me that I know somebody that's still having flashbacks from that era, and the homeless figures for vets is extremely high. So we have these people who are psychological basket cases, and it's not just the Tigers either. So, but I wanted to know if you interviewed Hackworth before he died, and whether you made the journalistic effort to at least ask Cheney and Rumsfeld and Powell, maybe, since he was involved in the cover-up in Malai, for their comments when you wrote the book.
Well, yes. We one of the first things we did was we contacted Hackworth, since he created the unit. Now, Hackworth leaves Vietnam and is actually reassigned to the Pentagon in, I think, late 1966. So Hackworth was not there during this reign of terror, so to speak, the Trail of Atrocities. We did contact him. He would not talk to us. He said, look, you know, even though in his book about Face, he does mention the Tigers and that period in his life, he refused to talk to us. Later, we went back to him after the series ran, and we tried to talk to him again, and, you know, he refused. As far as asking...
He's notoriously vocal, and he had his own website. And
It was surprisingly that he... Yeah. It was very surprising that Hackworth was silent on this, considering his history and
too.
Considering how outspoken he was. And when it came to Tiger Force, and he knew what we had, he was... He's reticent, to say the least. He did not talk to us. He you know, because we wanted to know. I mean, it goes back to the leadership issue. And the question is, if Hackworth was still involved in Vietnam, if he had been there, would the Tigers have gone on this rampage? Because everything, you know, goes back to strong leadership. And he wouldn't even answer any of those questions. And as far as Rumsfeld and Cheney, yes, we tried repeatedly to ask them. And the only response that we got, and they were very protected, very insulated, you know, from us. I mean, we'd have to go through spokesmen and this. We couldn't even get into a press conference because we were from the Toledo Blade. And, you know, the only people that get into those press conferences, people that have access, are people from the New York Times and the Washington Post. And their response was, we don't remember the case. End of quote. And again, it just seems to me illogical that they wouldn't have at least known about this particular case when it was the last war crimes case of the Vietnam War. It just boggles the mind, and especially when the White House was so freaked out about war crimes. We're talking about the Nixon White House and then later the Ford White House. They didn't want this stuff out. They did not want this stuff out. You have to remember that after My Lai, the first thing President Nixon says is, My Lai's an isolated incident. Okay? Then he goes back and he tells James Dean, we have to monitor all war crimes cases because I never want another My Lai to come out. So you have to understand the paranoia of the time.
Yeah, well, Callie served, 6 months of a very long sentence, but it was commuted by Nixon, and I think he actually consults. He lives right next to the School of Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, so he's sort of an example of impunity in the American military for the Latins that come to learn whatever they learn there these days. Thanks. I think it's extremely relevant for right now. The only other question I had from this colloquy is, that didn't you ever ask one of your cohort in the Washington Post or the Times to ask the question? And did they?
Well, we try. You know this is yes. When the story came out, the Associated Press picked it up and it went out all over the world. But strangely enough, after that initial story, the AP story ran in, you know, like the Washington Post and some of the other newspapers, nobody jumped on the story. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, we got a call from Seymour Hersh. And he said he read the series, he loved it, and he asked some questions like, what's the New York Times? How come I haven't seen any follow-ups in the Washington Post? It seems like you're the only newspaper in the country that's doing any follow-ups. And we told him that, you know, basically everyone's dropped it, except for us. And then he wrote a column in The New Yorker for the Talk of the Town where he praised the series, and he says that basically the reason The New York Times didn't cover it was because they got beat on the story, and if they had published it, you know, it would be in the news for months. And I think to a certain degree there's a lot of truth in that. The reason that the newspapers with access to Rumsfeld, the access to Cheney, didn't ask was because they just didn't care. A lot of times the national media just feels so comfortable. It's a little different now, but 3 years ago when we came out with the series, there's that comfort level between, you know, the national media that has access and the figures like Rumsfeld, Cheney, and Bush.
These four stories you wrote for the paper appeared in the fall of 2003, and so the stories, it certainly had some impact. You got the Pulitzer Prize. It's now a book. The Army has had to because you guys put the story out there again, the Army has had to make some response. What of the Army and the Pentagon, what now has been the official response to this, particularly to this question going to them that, well, you investigated, you found evidence of war crimes. Why did you stop there?
You know, it's very interesting what the response was. They, at first, they for the story, they didn't even comment. Then after the international reaction came out, they decided that they would reopen the investigation. They would look at the original investigation. They would look at what we published, because a lot of what we published was not only based on their investigation, but new stuff that you know, we got from interviews with vets and documents we uncovered. And they said, we're going to reopen it, look into the allegations. Well, it's 3 years later, and the only new development in the case, it's not closed yet, but the only new development in the case was they had a JAG who looked into the findings, and they recommended, that JAG recommended bringing Hawkins back, into service and court-martialing him. And you can do that if somebody collects a military pension, then you can actually bring them back to active duty and then, court-martial them. That's not unusual. In a war crimes case, it's very unusual. The Army has not made a decision whether they're going to do that or not, but I can't imagine this administration calling back a Vietnam veteran for a war crimes trial. I just can't see that happening. But, as far as we know, the case is still active to this day.
And that was when that was reported, that was in the fall of 2004, wasn't it?
It's been coming up
on 2 years.
Right. And, in fact, what we did was when we started the book, we were under contract that we couldn't write any more Tiger Force stories until the book was published. However, there was a third guy on the series. His name was Joe Marr, who's now at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and he actually did some follow-up stories. And he would check like every 2 weeks, and they would always tell him, "Case still open, case still open." Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like we forgot the case. We kept checking and checking, and again, it's still open. The recommendation is out there from that JAG to bring Hawkins back, because the ironic part was, of those 18 soldiers, a lot of them were still in the military, including Hawkins. And after the case is dropped, you would think the military would have done something; they would have reprimanded him. Instead, he's promoted to a major. He stays in the military another 3 years, then retires and spends another 20 years in the military as a civilian flight instructor at Fort Rucker, Alabama. So, the military, it was a case of the military taking care of its own.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Mitch Weiss. He's an editor with the Charlotte Observer, former reporter for the Toledo Blade. He is the co-author, along with Michael Sala, of the book Tiger Force, A True Story of Men and War. It's published by Little Brown, and it is an expansion of a story that he reported for the paper, for the Toledo Blade, back in the fall of 2003. They were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting for this story in 2004. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's continue here. Let's talk with someone on a cell phone. This is line number 4. Toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Since the fatality rate for the Vietnamese was officially 2 million and maybe unofficially 4 million, this incidence with the Tiger Force seems perhaps just the tip of the iceberg. And what do you think about that this type of activity might have been quite much more frequent than we know?
Well, I think that most of our – let me just preface it by saying that most of the troops in Vietnam served honorably. But there were certain areas of the country where there was high rate of combat where, I'm sure that there were other incidents of civilians being killed. Combatants, being mistaken for non-combatants being mistaken for combatants, and that did happen. I think the difference, though, with Tiger Force, which sets it apart from, the rumors of other atrocities, is that these were documented. That the Army spent 4.5 years investigating these allegations and substantiating, these war crimes, and that was the difference. Did it happen in other areas? It probably did. Was Vietnam a widespread atrocity? No, I don't believe so. I think most of our troops did serve honorably. What it comes back to, again, is what I mentioned earlier, is leadership. You need strong leaders that keep troops in line. And when they don't, that's when you run into trouble. And you can see that with our troops in Iraq now. We've had soldiers who have been charged with atrocities. And what I would say is, let's look at the leadership structure that was in place at the time. Let's look at some of the lieutenants who were, you know, in charge, the commanders. You look at Haditha, you know, it looks like the command structure knew what happened after the fact and tried to cover it up. So some of the same issues that took place in Vietnam are resurfacing now in a different country, different conflict.
Well, why I say that is McNamara, reflecting on Vietnam, thought that if we lost the war, we would have been tried, the leaders would have been tried for war crimes, and I'm talking the president on down.
Well, yes and no. I mean, our leaders would never been charged with war crimes. So it was Vietnam was a different war. It was a different era. The figure between 2 and 4 million. Yeah, it was high, and it was because of the relentless bombing. I think more than troops committing atrocities. Not that bombing is not an atrocity, but it was really the relentless bombing that caused, I think, the high death toll among the population.
If you're bombed, you're not looking for weapons, then that's not considered. Isn't that considered an atrocity?
Yeah, I agree with you to a certain extent that, you know, if you're firing on somebody and there are no weapons found, you have to look at the circumstances. I mean, with Tiger Force, they were not fog of war killings. They were premeditated. They would go into a village, and they knew before they went in there that they were going to kill people. And that's what they did. I mean, a lot of the soldiers said, look, we were angry, we're being hit, we may have lost a guy, you know, because of a sniper. And when we went into a village, and if we saw anybody there, regardless of whether they were men, women, and children, we're going to line them up and kill them. And that's exactly what they did.
Well,
I kind of think that we lost the caller there. I'm sorry. I think we had the connection sort of broke up there at the end. I appreciate his comment. Just to tie it into where we are today, it seems that the military is somewhat more willing to publicly address the issue of allegations of crimes and misconduct committed by soldiers in Iraq. Do you think that, in fact, that's the truth? Are they more willing, less likely to try to cover something like this up?
Oh, no. In fact, just the opposite. You know, it's my opinion, if you look at all the atrocities that have come out, you know, the allegations that have come out of Iraq, it's because of the media. I mean, you know, the government knew, the military knew about the prison scandal, and yet it wasn't until Seymour Hersh broke that story and we saw the photos that it became an issue. You know, it was Time magazine that broke the story of Haditha, and we found out that the military knew months earlier. In fact, they tried to pay compensation to the victims' families. We know in this particular case where, in fact, the soldier was actually arrested in Charlotte, North Carolina. I think his name is Stephen Green, the soldier from the 101st Airborne who's accused of raping a woman and then killing her and then killing, you know, the family. And the military knew about these allegations earlier. And it wasn't until an Iraqi civil rights group came forward to the media and talked about it that, you know, that we found out about this particular case. So the military hasn't been more open. It's just that the press has been a little more aggressive than they were at the very beginning of the war when, you know, the press was more cheerleader than journalists. So, yeah, no, I think you have that mechanism in place now, and it's the same kind of mechanism that we're going to cover things up. We're not going to let the people know what's really going on.
Well, let's talk to somebody else here. Spring Bay is the next caller, line one. Hello.
Oh, good morning. My gut level feeling is that there's a lot of stuff that we wouldn't be very pleased about going on in Iraq. You were writing about something that happened close to 40 years ago now, and I'm just feeling that our journalists today are really just not all that interested in covering these stories. I have called my local congressman twice, his office, to get an explanation for his position on torture. He voted, Ray LaHood, voted against McCain's torture ban amendment, and I believe there were about 100 and some other congressmen that did that. Most of them, most of the Central Illinois congressmen voted against it. The president then, you know, put his signing thing on it when he signed it, saying that he was basically going to do whatever he wanted to do. And I just have the feeling that there's an awful lot of stuff going on that we're not going to be very pleased with. So your comment on what do you think the current condition of our journalists are, and maybe even is your paper looking into anything that's going on in Iraq today? And I'll hang up and listen offline. Thank you.
Very good questions. At first I was very disappointed with the journalists who were over there at the, you know, covering the war. You know, before the war started, we kept hearing about weapons of mass destruction, and yet there wasn't a newspaper in this country that investigated whether or not that indeed was true. Then the reporters we sent over there, the military was very smart in Iraq. They had embedded journalists with all the different divisions and platoons, and that was great because what it did was they took reporters from all these small newspapers and mid-sized newspapers around the country, and they embedded them. And basically, these reporters were more cheerleaders, and they didn't cast an objective eye over the situation, what was really going on in Iraq. So hence, for the first 6, 7, 8 months of the war, we got this wonderful vision of American troops going into Iraq. Things were wonderful, you know, mission accomplished. And then, you know, towards the end of 2003, that's when we started seeing some of the bombings, and then, you know, the prison photos came out. And I think the press is doing a better job now than they did at the very beginning. And so I was really disappointed with some of the coverage early in the war. And, you know, when you look at this administration and you look at what's going on, I mean, this is an administration that basically has suspended the Geneva Conventions. And these, the conventions are doctrines that all the countries try to adhere to, that we're not going to torture prisoners, that we're going to treat, you know, combatants with respect, you know, POWs with respect. And we've thrown all that out the window. And, you know, it's a shame we've done that, because one of the reasons we're in Iraq, I think, to a certain degree, is because we're setting a moral tone. We're saying we're Americans, we have a better way of doing things. We're trying to spread democracy. And I think it runs, you know, by the torture and suspending the Geneva Conventions, it runs counter to everything that we stand for.
The events that you write about in the book, the rampage that the Tiger Force man went on, this all happened in over a period of months between May and November 1967. What, and even when the investigation was going on, when Gus Apsey and other people who were with CID went to try to talk to people to find out what had happened, even then, so many guys said, look, that was a long time. Then they were saying, that was a long time ago. That was then. I don't want to talk about it. I'm sure that still would be the reaction of a lot of people who would say, now it really was a long time ago. It's best forgotten. It's best not dug up. At this point, what purpose would be served if, for example, the Army brought James Hawkins back into active service so that they could court-martial him?
Well, I don't know what purpose would be served if you brought him back. I know that, you know, in civil rights cases, we're going back 40, 50, you know, years, and you have all these police, you know, departments that have cold case units that go back 10, 20 years to solve crimes. We have to remember that there were victims and families that are left behind in Vietnam, and we know exactly, because of government records and documents, we know exactly where those victims' families are. But I think what's really important about Tiger Force is that the Army acknowledges what happened, and that you learn from it, and you learn that you need to rotate troops, and that you learn that you have to have strong leaders in the field, and you learn that when there are allegations of atrocities, you need to investigate right then and there on the spot and get to the bottom of it. And if you find that somebody is guilty or there's probable cause, you court-martial, you set an example. And that's what I think the lesson of Tiger Force is for all of us to learn, for the military to learn, is use it as a teaching tool to prevent it from happening again. And, maybe if they did that in 1975, you know, and they and started to incorporate some of those principles at the military academies, and maybe you wouldn't have these kinds of incidents coming up. But you know, that would be my hope, is that, you know, the military would learn from this.
Yeah, I know some of the people you'll talk to, particularly I guess Gus Apsey, maybe felt that he had dropped the ball himself somewhat. You know, he did this investigation, he found evidence of war crimes. For his work, he was shuffled off to South Korea. Even he, though, said that he thought he didn't do a thorough enough job.
Well, yes. I mean, because he was a stickler for details. You know, Gus Apsey himself is an interesting story. His father was an SS officer during World War II, was killed by the Yugoslav resistance. And, you know, then his mother marries an American GI and he ends up in this country. So that's one of the twists. But yeah, he was a stickler, and but you know, this was a guy who was being undermined by agents in the field. He was conducting this unpopular investigation, and he did the best he could. I think in the end, Gus Apsey is a hero of the story because he didn't give in. He knew there was wrongdoing. He kept pushing ahead. He went up the food chain. He wanted to charge the commanders. In fact, he recommended charges against Morris, and there was a captain, you know, Carl James. He recommended charges, and then the case was dropped. So I think he did the best job he could. He was actually a pretty good investigator.
Well, we're going to have to come to the end. We have come to the end. We're going to have to stop. If people want to read the story, you can find this book, Tiger Force, A True Story of Men and War, published by Little Brown, in your bookstore, by our guest Mitch Weiss and also Michael Sala. The two of them received the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting for their work on the Toledo Blade newspaper and their series on Tiger Force. And you can still read the stories there on the website of The Blade, or you can go out and look for the book. Right now, Mitch Weiss is an editor with the Charlotte Observer. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure, David. Thank you for having me on the show.